Hello, everyone. My name is John Williams, and I'm the Chief Executive of the Institute of Leadership and Management. And I welcome you to our monthly podcast show, Leadership at the Edge, where we share ideas across the community of leadership practice in every context, everywhere. Each month, I'm joined by senior leaders from around the world to discuss their real life experiences, to challenge some of the outdated leadership practices, and to offer a fresh take on the issues that today's leaders face. We invite you to join the conversation via social media using the hashtag Leadership at the Edge, or to send a voice message via the podcast page on Anchor with your questions to our guest. To register for future podcasts and events, visit our website, institutelm.com, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast series and leave a review. In this episode, we'll be discussing the always absorbing topic of business agility. And I am privileged to have business agility expert and author Evan Laybourne as my guest. With over 15 years in business leadership and a proven track record of innovation, Evan is the founder and chief executive of the Business Agility Institute, an international membership body to both champion and support the next generation of organizations. And as well as leading the Business Agility Institute, Evan is also the author of Directing the Agile Organization. And his experience while holding senior leadership and board positions in both private industry and government has driven his work in business agility, regularly speaking at local and international industry conferences. So who better to equip us with the tools to thrive in today's unpredictable markets? Evan, welcome to you, sir.
Thank you, John. What you didn't say is we've known each other for a couple of years, and is every time we have a conversation, it has been an absolute delight. So I'm looking forward to having this opportunity once again.
Oh, that's marvelous. It's great of you to say that, actually, Evan, and you're right. We have known each other for a few years, although unfortunately, because of the current pandemic, have not been able to get together very much. And actually, it sort of leads us quite nicely into the first of the things that we wanted to talk about, really, which is the last 2 years, of course, which have been a sort of, I suppose, an unprecedented opportunity to road test agility in organizations. And I wanted to ask you, Evan, if we could, do you think that leadership in general has been up to the challenge of that road test of business agility?
So it's been very hit and miss. There have been definite leaders who have risen to the challenge, and there are leaders who have been ready for the challenge, but there have been just as many who really have not been able to respond. And I pick that word very deliberately because the alternative to responding is reacting. And that's what we've seen a large number of leaders and organizations do. Not panic per se, but disconnected, reactive, strategic decisions and tactical and operational decisions that are based on the circumstances of the day. But as much as those leaders have, many of them have learned and developed, because as I said, this has gone on now for 2 years. So the leaders who were reacting in 2020 are starting to learn how to respond today, or at least those who have survived long enough to do so.
Yes.
But it's those who have been responding, those who have created that strategic feedback loop. Like, we don't have enough information, but I have to make a decision today. So that decision will have these hooks such that the next decision I have to make tomorrow, because I know I'm going to have to make another decision tomorrow because we'll have more information tomorrow.
Yep.
We can use those hooks to create this linked and improved series of decisions. So the final decision that I make in a year or 2 years or however long this pandemic is going to last again, is going to be better than those that are disconnected and reactive.
Oh, that's really interesting, because that's a sort of, in a sense, a classic opportunity for agility, where we don't have a scenario where people can strategically plan for the next couple of years. So they have to almost deconstruct the big decision they would normally take strategically and respond. And I take that point about the difference between that and reaction in a way that is nevertheless almost day by day. which is a very rapid timeline for a response, because response does take some thinking time before you respond. Yeah. And do you think those who have been successful at that have been able to role model that successful sort of sense and response for their teams well enough?
Yes. And so this is one of the things that we've learned. So the Business Agility Institute, we are a research organization and an advocacy organization. So in one of the pieces of research that we've been undertaking throughout the COVID-19 pandemic has been looking at behaviors in these modern, new, adaptive, resilient, agile organizations. Yep. And when we look at the behaviors, we actually define the behaviors as either executive-oriented behaviors, leadership-oriented behaviors, and everyone behaviors, which obviously you don't have to be in a leadership role to behave in these ways.
Sure.
What we have seen, however, is that where organizations have invested and are developing these leadership-oriented behaviors, the everyone behaviors increase. The increase increases. So not quite exponential, but that kind of curve.
Yep.
So that we know, and those leaders who get it help others to get it. And I'll give you a really, really simple example. And it comes down to listening to staff and listening to frontline staff specifically. You can sort of think of that stereotypical monolithic 1970s mega corporation, and it's the chain of command and the chain of communication. Yep. And if a decision is made, it's made at the top and trickles down.
Yep.
Whereas in a pandemic, the person who knows what the customer is doing first is the person who's dealing with the customer, and whether that is on the checkout or a service. And they can tell, they know that something is happening. And we saw this very much with the spike of Omicron, because Omicron moved faster than anything before. And we saw organizations who had that sort of like data-driven organization. It takes time for that data to feed through, to see the trends, to go, oh, hang on.
Yes.
Customer spending is down. Consumer sentiment is down. Whereas those organizations that had that leadership behavior of engaging with and communicating and listening to and learning from, and better still, actually delegating decision rights to those people at the front, were seeing the impact of Omicron before it was visible more generally, and could actually make operational and strategic decisions accordingly.
That's excellent, because a number of things jump out of that. The idea of listening as opposed to relying upon data analysis, which takes time because of the lag in the data and stuff like that. And also the crucial, absolutely crucial element there of delegation and that devolution. It brings me on to another question, actually, because we've seen huge growth in the public sector element of our economies and society over the course of the last couple of years, because governments have, in a sense, in some cases, have had to take control of greater parts of our lives. Are we seeing that both that increase in public sector control and maybe some of that delegation, because there's a bit of a tension between those two things. How are we seeing that reflected in the differing abilities of the public and private sector to adopt agile behaviors?
I don't think I've ever been asked that question before. It's a good one. So I'm just going to talk a perception. This is just my opinion at this
Absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely. Yep.
But I think if we look at the speed in which companies were able to sort of put in place work from home practices, I've worked for organizations where if I wanted to work from home, I had to put in a request to my manager that went to security, and 3 months later, through various back and forths, I'd eventually get the security fob or token to allow me to log in via an archaic version of Citrix or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And March 2020, April 2020, really, and suddenly the government, yes, it's like, all right, lockdowns. And I live in Melbourne, right? Melbourne, Australia. Right.
Yep.
I believe we had the record for longest lockdown until fairly recently.
Yep.
So, yeah, like governments did come in and say, it's like, this is the public health and safety. This is what we need to do. We're going to go into lockdown. And organizations, rather than taking that same, I'll say heavy-handed, not in a criticism of the government, because sometimes the right decision isn't necessarily the nice decision.
Right.
But it was definitely heavy-handed, probably appropriately so. But the organizations, on the other hand, took a much more human approach in terms of, all right, we all have to work from home. We know this. All right, everyone, we're going to chip in. We're going to figure it out. We're going to work together. And look, just go home, do what you can as best you can while we figure this out for the next couple of days. And ideas were coming in. So it was a lot more collaborative. It was a lot more, we know this is a systemic problem. It requires a systems or a systemic solution, which is not going to come from an authoritarian thou shalt governance response from corporate HQ.
Right.
And another example, in the United States, they had their PPE loan. Oh, forgive me for any American listeners. I think it was a PPE loan.
Yep.
It was basically like a small business loan.
Yeah.
And I was talking to one of our members who's a bank, and they went from doing a couple of thousand a year to doing $500,000 in a couple of weeks. And it just because of the way the government had structured their spend, the way they were supporting most businesses and so forth was through this loan mechanism.
Yeah.
And so again, it didn't matter who you were. Right? Yeah. You could be a banking clerk whose job was to deal with these loans.
Yep.
You could be a teller. You could be the head of marketing. You were expected to roll up your sleeves, as long as you had the appropriate licenses, which the head of marketing had the appropriate licenses, and their job was to process these loans because they had to.
Yep.
And so it became very much this collaborative approach. Now, not every organization was as good as that, but we definitely saw that more human approach.
Very interesting, because that's a sort of, and I understand exactly what you mean about this, the sort of, we'll call it the heavy hand of control, just because actually it was a little heavier than we would normally expect government to be in terms of their engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And then the contrast of the light touch of letting go of control that the private sector actually had no choice but to engage in. Like, as you say, a bank to go from a couple of thousand to $500,000 almost overnight, no individual of a command and control nature can do that at all.
Yeah.
And actually, that for me is it's an interesting illustration of the not just the ability of the private sector to pivot, but the number of moving parts in the private sector actually is fewer than in the public sector. There's no political imperative, for example, to fulfill. There are no what's the word? Maybe fewer public good requirements on the private sector, perhaps, and things. Do you think that's valid?
I actually don't. I'm going to disagree with you.
Oh, good. Good. This is what makes a market, Edmund.
So I think the flavor is different, but it's we're all human at the end of the day, and our political systems are a reflection of human nature and how we act. And our corporations are exactly the same. Now, corporations have different motivations and different intents, different value propositions, but it's the same humans who make up those companies as make up our political systems. Tribalism, jingoism, right? Siloed mentality. One of the catchphrases of many sort of business and agile business agility transformations, and for any listeners who haven't caught on by now, if you're familiar with agile in a tech space, we're not talking agile in a tech space, we're talking business agility, which is a different thing. There's links between the two, but they are different. But in any kind of transformation, whether it be a tech agile one, a business agility one, or just a business transformation, one of the mantras or the principles that comes out is this break down the silos.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we're going to break the silos. And I call rubbish on that. Being Australian, I generally use a word a little bit harsher than rubbish. But because this is recorded, I'm going to just say rubbish. You can't break down silos, because silos are a very human affectation. It's what we create, us versus them.
Yep.
What is the problem is when those silos are destructive, when right. and not competitive, like a little bit of like sports. We can handle competition, right? But it's when that competition, when that tension between those silos becomes destructive. And so the goal in, say, a transformation in breaking down the silos is to figure out how to form silos that are constructive rather right. or collaborative, or at least neutral rather than destructive. And I think that in the political sphere, unfortunately, global politics is a bit of a mess right now, and yeah. that us versus them has definitely become destructive in politics.
Yep.
I think what business does better than certainly politics is that a business can fail. And yes, governments can fail too, but that's rarer and much harder.
Yep.
A business can fail. And like, we always talk about surviving, right? Like businesses surviving and so forth. But no, like again, that's rubbish. A company, a business has to earn the right to exist. Yep. Right? And they can fail because they don't serve their customer. Right? And they can fail because internally they are a broken, fractured, destructive organizational yep. culture and organizational structure.
Yep.
A government can't fail, right? Or more other, we do not want them to
fail. We don't want them to, yes.
So it's a lot of these destructive tendencies tend to just be accepted, and they often either snowball, or as generational change comes in, things get smoother and better and so forth. But I do disagree that there's a difference. It's humans in both.
Very, very interesting. And thanks for that, because actually you've prompted me to think in new ways, which is what we really should be doing here. And it just reminds me of, there's a great article by Nico Colchester, and he talks about crunchy and soggy. And it's worth, for those people who haven't read it, I won't spoil the fun, but it's worth Googling Nico Colchester, crunchy and soggy, because it has a very similar description of the way the world works to what you've just outlined there, actually. And of course, the profit imperative that drives the private sector is a very clear call to action, and around which quite a lot of different behaviors and indeed different conflicts can rally, which is quite useful. Evan, we're 20 years on now from the Agile Manifesto. It was the 20th anniversary last year, and business agility is, in a sense, has become an industry in its own right, not least thanks to the growth and development of the Business Agility Institute, actually propagating the principles of agility in a broader sense than just the tech sphere. Do you think there is a direction, and particularly think about the role that the Institute can play, do you think there's a direction that business agility should be heading or promoting to deliver the kind of leadership that we need for the future?
So 20 years ago, as you say, the Agile Manifesto was signed. This was the foundation of the values and the principles that underline what I would say most product or technology product organizations have adopted. And if you're familiar with the concept of crossing the chasm, the change adoption curve.
Yep.
Agile is very much now in that late majority. I started in the technical agile world back in 2003, and back then it was very much a we had to argue for every inch of ground in terms of what we could or what we wanted to do in this agile space. But now, if an organization doesn't want an agile product approach, it's a choice. It's not this this second cousin that you kind of invite over for holidays and that's it. But it's a default approach for many organizations, and not doing it is as a choice as much as doing it itself.
Right.
Business agility, which can draw its heritage from some of those values and those principles, when we're looking at things like creating these adaptive and resilient and very human approaches to marketing, and HR and finance, it's very important. But we haven't crossed the chasm yet. And it's this need, this design of organizations to understand that they are systems, and agility in one part of the system, for example, technology or product, doesn't mean that you have agility. It does, and in fact, the agility in that part is limited, constrained. If we go back to the theory of constraints by Eli Goldratt, it's constrained by the agility of the rest of the organization. So it doesn't matter if you can deploy a change to a product in 2 weeks or 2 days, if it takes you 6 months to get a hiring ticket or 9 months to get a budget change approved. Your agility as a system, as an organization, is limited by everything else. So what we're seeing now is these early adopters, organizations in banking, in manufacturing, in telecommunications, who are starting to realize that for them, their strategic advantage it's not in the products. Well, it's partly in the products that they create, but it's also in large part in the speed in which they can adapt their business when the markets change. And let's just forget COVID for a moment. I know it's hard, right? But let's just pretend it didn't exist. Like, let's go back 2 years. Change, disruption is a natural state in all organizations, in all industries, in all organizations. And so the fintechs disrupting the banks, and the banks going, well, how do we get a piece of this? Because it's death by a thousand cuts. Yep. I was part of a strategic plan for a large bank in Asia. And when they did their SWOT analysis and looking at their competitors, the analysis from 5 years earlier, which of course they did a 5-year plan that far back, it was like the other banks across Asia. When they did it again, and this is 6 or 7 years ago now, it was Alibaba, Amazon, Apple, Google. This is who they were afraid of. They weren't afraid of the other banks. And so this idea of creating a customer-centric organization with engaged employees who have ownership, they are engaged and they take personal ownership of the outcomes that they're creating, and moves and pivots and adapts faster than their competitors, that's survival. It's not the big fish eats the small fish, it's the fast fish eats the slow fish, and that's the change.
Very, very interesting, because that idea of competitive advantage then, it completely changed. The strategy map no longer has, as you quite rightly said, the people we used to have on the strategy map looking backwards, they're no interest to us now. It's a competitive advantage against other potentially unexpected competitors, really. So and in that context then, I think almost one last question for me, really, and this is the classic top tip question, this in that context of unexpected uncertainty and stuff like this, what's the one piece of advice that you would give anyone aspiring to become a truly agile leader in a business agility sense, whatever sector they work in?
So I'm going to answer it twice, right? Because I'm going to give you a systems answer as an organization. So not you as a leader, but leadership and how organizations structure. And that is, look at how people are measured. And there's a great quote, and I forget who said it, I'm afraid. You get the behavior that you measure. Actually, another great quote, Peter Deming, mm-hmm. W. Edwards Deming. If you give someone a measurable target, they will destroy the company in order to achieve it.
Yes.
So at a systems level, one of the best things that you can do to change behavior yep. is to change what you measure and how you measure it.
Right.
And unfortunately, most organizations have very crude, very blunt measures, yep. and they get very crude and very blunt behaviors and responses to those measures.
Yep.
But I'm going to go very now personal. So not just at a systems, but an individual leader. So one of the things that when I first became an executive back in 2008 in the Australian government, I'd reached my level of incompetence, promoted to your level of incompetence, the Peter principle. That was
yes.
it. And it took a very good manager, my boss above me, to point out my failings and my mistakes. And I won't go into all of that. That's a much longer story. But one of the things that I sort of, he called me arrogant, right? And that hurt because I don't yeah. see, that's not my mental model of myself. And definitely I hope I've improved since then. But one of the things that I realized was that I was expressing confidence really well.
Right.
And confidence, I think, is one key attribute of leadership. But when I was like thinking about myself and how to improve, I drew two additional like points,
yep.
empathy
yep.
and competence or skill.
Right.
And confidence and competence, skill without empathy is arrogance. Competence and empathy without confidence is untrustworthy. Not that they can't be trusted, but that we naturally trust people who express confidence.
Right.
And so, yep. so it's hard to be trusted if you don't express confidence.
Yep.
And similarly, empathy and confidence without competence yep. is a fraud. Like
yes.
you can't actually do the job that you're hired for. So for me, it's those three measures that I think are the keys to success
right.
and necessary in a modern leadership role where you're leading people, engaging people, delegating, developing people, rather than a process management role, which may be a little bit more technically, I need to do A, B, C, D, E. And so that CEC, competence, empathy, and confidence, I think are the keys to leadership.
Evan, that's an absolutely brilliant place, I think, to I won't say end the conversation, because I know that you and I are going to have a lot more conversations around these subjects in the not too distant future, indeed. But I particularly like that ending point and the fact that you answered it twice. The idea from an organizational perspective of actually changing what we measure and how we measure it because of the implications of measuring things which are not the right things for the future of the organization. And then that very nice model of confidence, empathy, and competence, which I think I'm sure most of our leaders will be able to espouse and the rationale behind it. Evan, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us today. My thanks to our audience, of course, but special thanks, I think, to Evan Laybourne and to the audience for listening. Please do join the conversation via social media using the hashtag #LeadershipAtTheEdge or send the voice message via the podcast page on Anchor. And for more of our podcasts and events and lots of other content, visit our website, www.institutelm.com. Subscribe to the podcast series, leave a review, and mention us to your colleagues. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening.